So, questions and answers. I'm feeling spacious in my heart. It is pleasant, and then I get sleepy. Can you advise on how to cultivate interest in the spaciousness? My effort is tight, and I fall asleep easily. That's a fairly common sort of conundrum in that sense of you recognize how there's kind of the benefits and drawbacks in everything. You say, oh, wow, gee, it'd be nice to feel some kind of spaciousness and peace for once in my meditation. And then, of course, then you feel that and then you get sleepy. And sort of the so that embedded in different mental states are always, one has to recognize the drawback or the something that can be problematic. Something like spaciousness, and then it's feeling pleasant, then it's actually helpful to take there's different ways that one can do it. Either one could, besides the spaciousness, one could bring up a perception of light, so that along with that spaciousness, it doesn't sort of go into sort of the space turning into the void and one disappearing into the void. So that sense of bringing up a perception of light as well, so that there's a brightness that comes with that, and the brightness tends to energize. Another way of working with that, in the sense of, as a quality of spaciousness arises, and that feeling of pleasantness, but then to really take the sensation of the breath. And to really clarify it, there's this feeling. It is pleasant. It's spacious. It feels settled. But then, it needs to be kind of shaped a bit so that it doesn't sort of go like the sense of spaciousness ends up without being able to define any boundaries. So then, one needs to define the boundaries a bit more and sort of to shape it a bit so that there's an engagement with the object of attention and the meditation, so that those are a couple sort of ways. But I think you get the principle behind it, is that within that that pleasant, spacious, you start to recognize a pattern. Oh, well, I tend to drift off. So then there needs to be a bit more structure that one is able to define things a bit more clearly. And then if you tend to, say, define it too tightly, then you'll wear yourself out, or it'll feel tense, and then you have to back off. So there's this experimenting with where you go forward. Okay, well, that's not working. Well, I'm going to come back a bit. But the main thing, or the main indicator, is that there is this quality of awareness, mindfulness, clarity that's able to be sustained. That's working with the object. Do you have any ghost story at Wat Nana Chan? It's getting to be a few days into retreat, and then that breath is getting really boring. let's see. I mean, there's actually lots. One of the reasons why the forest is actually still there at Wat Nana Chan is because it was a charnel ground, and that was the place where burials and cremations took place, and there were all sorts of stories. I'll tell one that is probably very, it's probably very interesting. And this is not sort of ancient time, this is in my own time. So during toward the end of when I was the abbot at Wat Nana Chan, then there's a woman who used to come, and she had her and her husband would come, and then he was a police officer and a senior police officer, so he had two daughters that were going to school, and they were going back to school in the city, into Bangkok, and there was an accident. That was on a tour bus. The tour bus was a horrific accident. One of the daughters was killed. One of the daughters was seriously injured. And of course, it was a tragedy for the family. And then one of the things that they did was build a kuti, or a small meditation cabin, in the women's section, and then her ashes were put into that kuti. Then some years went past, and I'd go back and visit. I came to America. I'd go back and visit every year, and then it was maybe 5-6 years after I'd come to America, or since the death of the girl, and I went back to visit, and there was this whole kerfuffle in the women's section because this ghost of this girl kept appearing to people. So then words sort of get around. They did some chanting, trying to do this. And then anyway, I was there, and I started talking to the mother, who I knew really well. And then in talking with her, what transpired was that she confessed to me that what she had been doing all the years since she died was that she'd, every time she did anything good, any meritorious deed, she would make a resolution that by the power of this merit, may my daughter be reborn as... because she had a son, and then the and her younger sisters, when they marry, have children, would she be reborn in that family? So she'd been, I think she'd been dead for, it was actually most, because I was a couple of years while I was there, so it was maybe 5, 6, 7 years, so it was probably 7, 8 years, maybe 9 years, 10 years, I'm not sure how long it was, but quite a long time. And then... so then it was sort of like, oh, there's the problem. And we had a medium speak with the daughter, and the daughter actually then said, I want, my mom is making these resolutions, and I can't take rebirth. Because the other sister, I mean, she's still not married, completely uninterested. And so she would like to just take rebirth, and rather than hanging around as a ghost by the power. So it's really, to me, it's really interesting with that. You think you're doing something really good sometimes, really, you know, and that you know, the power of attachment, it has an effect. And certainly, as soon as the mother realized that, then she was willing to relinquish her. Kind of her desire, her wish. So that's a ghost story. How do you expand your concentration and awareness beyond the breath when other conditions arise? I'm not 100% sure what, say, the reference to other conditions, but I'll give a couple scenarios. One is, you know, in terms of other conditions being things that one needs to engage in, so that using the concentration in terms of the mind is settled, it's focused, it's clear, there's awareness and attention, and that is to be transferred over, is to be brought to whatever task, whatever chore one is engaging in. These are the tools of concentration and awareness are not limited to, say, like a meditation technique on the cushion, but these are extremely skillful, powerful tools for for bringing into our daily life, into the different chores that we're doing. But it's a different quality in the sense that, again, that clear comprehension needs to play a role in the whatever engagement one is doing. We can't just be focusing and then blotting out the relationship that one has to activity or responsibilities or duties, but that that concentration and awareness is a very powerful and skillful tool for engaging in skillful activity. Another aspect of, say, other conditions is that uses the concentration awareness on the breath becomes, say, very settled, the body is settled, the mind becomes bright, and there comes a point where, as the mind becomes very settled, that if one doesn't go beyond the breath, then when it'll keep the mind, say, it won't be able to refine itself as well as it could if one dropped the breath and allowed that concentration and awareness to either absorb into something like a still point of sensation, which can be like the breath is settling, the breath is refining, and it comes into a point, and so that there's a sensation, but it doesn't feel like it's moving. So then one can absorb into that that concentration and awareness on that sense of touch and move into that. Another phenomena that can happen is that as the breath becomes more subtle and steady and still, then rather than the breath itself, there can be an image, oftentimes light, that's a very common, like a point of light can arise. And then to take that point of light as the focus of attention and allow that concentration and awareness to move into and kind of inhabit that perception. So that it's, say, moving beyond the breath, but one still, that what's basically happening is that the concentration and awareness are becoming more steady and subtle. And one has to, say, keep up with that, in that, say, how we pay attention to the object. The object of attention needs to be appropriate to the quality of mind, the state of the mind. As the mind becomes more refined, we need to pay attention to a more refined object. So we have to give the mind some work to do. And if you say, if it's too coarse, the mind will respond accordingly. So it'll lose its concentration. So one needs to be adjusting and experimenting so that there's this balance between the object that one is paying attention to and the actual state or quality of the mind itself. So it takes some observation and attention. So those are two different poles of moving beyond the breath. Can you talk about how different hand positions or mudras are used in meditation? I mentioned the other day about, and I'm not that skilled or familiar, the sort of Indian tradition has all sorts of these mudras that they use in different ways, and the Tibetan tradition has all sorts. We're the little vehicle, so we don't have much. But the one that is most common is just the hands in the lap, and then the thumbs raised slightly like that, so that one's just touching. And then that's a point of contact that one can use to be aware. As one's meditating, following the breath or whatever meditation object, then one brings attention back to that, say, that mudra. Am I holding it? Am I holding it too tight, too tense? is it gone all sort of loose and floppy? Have I lost the meditation object? Have I got distracted? So that it's a good reminder to using the body to, because it creates a certain sort of energy and attention with that physical contact. And it just gives, you don't have to pay a whole lot of attention to it, but it does give a little bit of edge of awareness and attention. And there's others that are used sometimes, seen used, like that, where it makes kind of a circle with the thumb and the forefingers of both. Again, that to hold it takes a little bit of energy. Sometimes that could be used. You see that sometimes just holding it on the knees. Sometimes that's a way to relax and open the shoulders, which is helpful for ones a bit maybe tense in the meditation or that feels comfortable. But sometimes it's using the, say, that mudra if ones are really having trouble with sleepiness, rather than letting the hands rest in the lap, just holding it up a bit higher. And that takes that little bit of extra effort, and it's not comfortable. So it's hard to drift off and go to sleep like that, but it does. It's sort of a level of engagement where one can let it drift off to the side of awareness, but it's sort of like a computer programmer running in the background, where you have to put that a little bit of energy, a little bit of effort there, so it helps the mind to keep alert. Those are a few that I know that I've experimented with. 8 precepts illuminates the vanity within. Could you offer some encouragement or reflections on the beauty of Dhamma as a remedy? Thank you. It's actually a classic meditation object, the recollections of Dhamma. And one of the reasons why one, say, uses that recollection or reflection on Dhamma is because of the faith, encouragement, confidence that arises when one considers the directness of the teaching, of that the truth that the Buddha taught, comprehensive penetration of the Buddha's, to be able to see this truth, this Dhamma, and then to be able to transmit it. So those kind of recollections are really very uplifting. And so that those recollections of Dhamma, that's their function, is to uplift the heart, to give that sense of confidence. And this is where some reading, study, listening to teachings is going back to the original sources of the suttas, where then one say, the Buddha actually taught that, and some of these teachings just really resonate in the heart, and to be able to remember them, bring them to mind, and they do give this tremendous sense of uplift and well-being, and it's a very useful emotion to be cultivating. Sometimes the common depiction of the goal of practice is to be completely cool, non-reactive, unmoving, unshakable, and one forgets to actually read the suttas and the teachings and realize, oh wow, there's this encouragement to delight in the Dhamma, to allow that emotion of kind of a zest that comes up in the heart when one contemplates the truth of the teachings. One of the disciples of Ajahn Mun, Lumpu Khao, and he's highly revered in Thailand. He passed away a long time ago. But in his account of his practice, he speaks of his realization, his enlightenment, came on reflecting on the nature of rice. I mean, it couldn't be more common in Thailand. But starting to think of that, and how it applied to the Dhamma that the Buddha taught, of that sense of, you know, just in the same way that rice grows from this little seed, and it grows and matures, and it provides sustenance, and then it has all sorts of, just from one seed that gets planted in the ground, and then all of this, the rice stalk matures, and then it produces hundreds and hundreds of seeds that can be a benefit to, and it can grow again or can provide sustenance. And then sort of just thinking on the causal nature of something like rice, and then sort of applying it to the way that the Buddha laid out the teachings. And that was the trigger for his own realization and enlightenment. And then that took place up in the north of Thailand. He was living in this little, very, very simple grass hut in a hill tribe village, very, very poor. And then he was saying when he left there, he viewed his hut and viewed his little place and sort of with this tremendous sort of fondness and gratitude and a sense of the heart really being really warm in recollection. Oh, this really served me so well. And this sort of this emotion of gratitude and appreciation. And then he said, I can really see how the Buddha had this tremendous appreciation and giving importance to the Bodhi tree. And that, oh yeah, well, that's exactly why. This is the place where the Buddha was enlightened, under the Bodhi tree. And so that sort of feeling, there's a special feeling towards that, an emotion. So that sense of, we look on, yeah, the beauty of Dhamma in different ways. Could you review again what the antidotes for the five hindrances are? Also, if one has not correctly identified the hindrance at the moment and uses the incorrect remedy, so what? Not skillful? Questions. Well, actually, when it's sort of having not identifying the hindrance, applying the incorrect remedy, then you've got still something to work with, so it's it's no big deal. I think the thing is, the whole point of it is actually seeing what actually works for oneself. I just gave some basic ideas or possibilities, because there's many, many different tools and antidotes that one can apply or experiment with, one just has to pay attention to, well, does it work? It does help to really identify a bit more clearly, well, what is the hindrance? So that when one does apply some sort of methodology or technique, then you've got some clear information for the future that, okay, maybe it'll work again. And it may not, but it's good to keep the information clear. Now, if with sense desire, the classic remedy is the unattractive aspects of the body, unattractiveness of the body, and I think one of the main reasons for that is the whole point of, sensual desire, it's kind of body-based, it's with the senses, it's looking for gratification external to oneself, and then to just review and sort of what we assume to be this vehicle for gratification and some kind of happiness, well-being, pleasure that we want to derive from external sources. We say, well, even that, the whole thing is fraught. And hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, skin. It's sort of like there's all these different component parts. And none of them are particularly attractive in and of themselves. None of them are solid and stable. They're constantly shifting and changing, so that it helps to develop that a quality of dispassion, coolness toward that outgoing energy. The hindrance of irritation, ill will, aversion is, say, the classic remedy is that's recommended is the cultivation of loving kindness, so that when in consciously bringing up a quality of loving kindness, then one is undermining the those roots of ill will and replacing it with something that is positive, is bright. I mean, there's many different ways that one can be working with ill will, aversion. I mean, one is just paying attention to the say the drawback or the say the harmful consequences of ill will. The image that the Buddha gives of say the results of ill will, like said, it's like throwing dust into the wind. It just blows back in your face, and, or spitting up into the air, and it splats down on your face again. It's not so fruitful. Antidotes for ill will are antidotes for sloth and torpor. Consciously putting forth effort into the meditation object, bringing up recollections of Dhamma, visualizations of light, opening the eyes, really energizing the posture, getting up and doing walking meditation, or standing out outside in the fresh air. Those are many of the kind of techniques. So it's not just limited to sit there until the sleepiness goes away, because sometimes you do that and you end up stretched out on your meditation cushion. So that sometimes you just, nothing's working. And you have to sort of physically get yourself up and move. Restlessness, anxiety, the classic antidote to restlessness, yeah, actually is mindfulness of breathing. So that soothing rhythm of the breath and allowing that rhythm of the breath to kind of permeate and fill the body so that it gives this restful feeling that helps to settle the mind down. And doubt, just reviewing teachings, reviewing and recollecting Dhamma, recollecting particular teachings that seem to resonate in some way, and it helps to build that confidence to get one over the hump of that doubt. And these are just, you know, a few. There's really so many different skillful techniques that people have tried and worked with and benefited from. But I think it's important for us as practitioners to experiment for ourselves and see, well, what works? What's interesting? What might work? Because it's actually more useful to experiment with something that might work and it not working, you know, in the sense that the hindrance is still there, but at least there's the you're stimulating the interest to explore, and there's a confidence that you gain from that, rather than being too fearful or worried of, did I get the right antidote as it's in the text or in the book? Or was that, do I remember that right? So you end up in doubt about that. So it's such an important way to kind of empower oneself, is just to explore and experiment and kind of own your own practice. It's really important. Late night news, sports, and a sleeping pill. Any suggestions how my mind is going to be affected in the long run? Well, so that putting off till some other time what needs to be done done now. You know, it's interesting to see how some things in certain contexts are actually quite, you know, really innocent. Yeah, late night news, sports, sleeping pill. I mean, it's all very innocent, really. But then, you know, it depends how we relate to it and how we rely on it, how we depend on it, how we build our life around certain things, not being able to, you know, the compulsiveness of checking the news, checking the sports, you know, that feeling of, you know, if I don't get my sleep, then the world isn't going to be right at all, worries around that. And so that being able to have an independence, or being able to be content within oneself, or clear within oneself, or relaxed and settled within oneself, and it's sort of building this independence that one can carry with one. And then you realize that, especially if one is away for some time, you know, 10 days, come back, and you realize, yeah, the world has gone by, and you didn't know what the late night news were, or what the sports scores were, and the world is still okay. So what is the difference between abandoning personality view, sakkaya ditti, and realizing anatta? And then there's another question after that. The personality view, or sakkaya ditti, is another way of translating that is identity view, so that one is identified with certain aspects of, and particularly some body, mind. This is who I am, this is my feelings are what I really am, what I really am, this is really me, I am my body, the body is me. This sense of self is, say, the vehicle is the body, and then the same for feelings, perceptions, our thoughts, consciousness itself, so that there's an identity, an identification that is invested in that. And that, so that, say, abandoning that identity and identifying the personality view is as what Ajahn Yatiko was speaking this afternoon. It's one of the first fetters that's abandoned in the realization of stream entry. And that is a realization of anatta to a certain degree, but it's not a full liberation or a full penetration of anatta, the ability to completely relinquish any kind of... So what is still left, because there's still the tendencies of the I position, the comparisons that one has with others, the feeling of inferiority, superiority, equal, those kind of comparisons are still there, even though you know that's crazy. But it's so deeply ingrained that is still not able to be relinquished until arhatship. So that the realizing of anatta would be, one could equate that with the full liberation and awakening. So that one gets an understanding of it, one gets a glimpse of how that works and realizes, oh yeah, this whole bundle of body-mind complex is a whole tangle, and that's not the whole creation of a self-view and an identity around that is really the way to create suffering. But there's still kind of the underlying tendency, still the underlying habit, and so that it needs to be refined and clarified and penetrated for anatta to fully, say, to manifest itself. The last question is, what is hasitupada jitta, consciousness producing mirth? That is the Buddha's smile. I think it's helpful to, one is sometimes the Buddha, there's this accounts of the Buddha smiling when he sees some circumstance that kind of tickles his fancy. Usually it's, you know, that's usually explained around the event from some past life or something that's not really apparent from for others. And but so, yeah, nothing's coming to mind at the moment from a story from the suttas where that happens. But I just have that recollection. But also, I think it's helpful to know that the Buddha did smile. Right? He did. And it was both sometimes took delight in or sort of enjoying the circumstances in his life, or sometimes being, I mean, some of the ways that he gave, kind of told stories or illustrated things. You want to see the other. Yeah, the Buddha had a pretty good sense of humor sometimes. I think of the, when he's telling Ananda, you know, before I was my enlightenment, my full awakening, you know, I was, you know, did all this extreme asceticism, and sometimes I would live on just one little fruit a day. And he said, and the fruit in those days was, you know, it wasn't bigger. It was just this little fruit still. One of my favorite images that the Buddha uses, he's admonishing the monks to be cautious around gains, honor, and fame. And this is something to be cautious of, be aware of, not to get involved in. It gives the image of a dung beetle, and the dung beetle sort of gets, you know, he gets this big pile of dung, and he sort of stands up on his big pile of dung and says, "I'm a dung beetle, and I've got a big pile of dung." You know? Yeah, and he's so proud of his big pile of dung. So it's just like monks who get infatuated with gain, honor, and fame. It's like this dung beetle. Thank you for teaching that listening to Dhamma is a spiritual practice, not just information download. When you opened your heart to Ajahn Chah, even though you couldn't understand his words, would you say that was a sort of Dhamma transmission, directly from one heart to another? Probably not. Well, I don't know. Maybe that is I'm kind of hesitant to, because sometimes there's this mystical kind of trappings that go, the mystical transmission, and I shy away from that kind of language, or that, yeah, the master is up there expounding and one is getting this transmission. Yeah, I don't go for that so much. But I tend to be pretty pedestrian in my approach to things. The transmission of Dhamma is not, it's not so much that one receives anything, but that one is actually open. And that's where one can say that, some kind of, it's that preparing of the heart to be really open and receptive. And there's where Dhamma can establish itself and say be, and really it's a transmission, like, directly from the Buddha himself, because it's, one is just really tuning into the true nature of things. And when one is open and willing to pay attention to the true nature of things, then it's there to be received. As wild and woolly as some of my experiences have been in the practice, I was wondering if there's a place for wilderness along the path. What is crazy wisdom? Well, I mean, it depends. Because there's certainly the... and sometimes there's another term that I'm hesitant to kind of endorse, because oftentimes it's used in a way of how can I justify my own defilements and quirks. But that being said, I think in any Buddhist tradition, any spiritual tradition, there's always a place for things that don't quite fit in the box, so to speak. And I think of one of Ajahn Chah's teachers, and he was definitely outside the box, very unpredictable, and he would do quite unexpected things, and some people thought he was crazy. Ajahn Chah, he had nothing but praise for him. On the night he passed away, he actually told people, his name was Ajahn Tonglet. It'd be a great project for... there was a group of students of Ajahn Chah who compiled a bit of a biography and stories of teaching stories and examples from his life. It was published in Thai, and it's never been translated into English. It'd be a great project. But there was one of the lay people who was a regular at Wat Nanachat. He was actually present at Ajahn Tonglet's passing away. And he said that Ajahn Tonglet had told people, "Well, come on such and such a night, there's something special is going to happen." and he was quite old, and he was kind of sick, and so people came, and he talked to them, gave teachings, and he was sitting up, and then he was sort of, and then he said, "Well, I'm kind of tired, I better lie down." He was lying down, continued teaching, and he was sort of talking away, explaining Dhamma and telling stories of Dhamma. And then at some point, after many hours of him teaching, he said, "I'm kind of tired now. I think that's about it. I'll take my leave." And then he died. That was it. So he never did anything quite in the box. Does the remembrance of mindfulness have to do with our karma? It's the other way around. Karma is actually the verb to do. So that, as we do mindfulness, we remember it more. It's the other way around. I've been experiencing and witnessing an incredible sadness. At times it is dormant, at times it seems all-consuming. I've done okay with staying present, questioning its nature, its benefits, its hindrances, its source. I haven't come up with a specific cause for this grief, sorrow. Do you have any suggestions for furthering my investigation, working with sadness, and how I might someday send it on its way? Great gratitude. I think one of the things is, it depends. Sadness can come from all sorts of different sources. Sometimes it can be that we actually take things so far too personally, and everything becomes heavy and a burden. That can be the case, and in that case, then we need to see how we're creating that burden. The other aspect is that, viewed from any sane perspective, the human condition is pretty sad, in a sense. We encounter endless disappointments, separations, difficulties, and we never get what we want. So it's like you're butting your head up against this wall all the time. So there is this kind of it's a condition that is conducive to sadness. The other side of the coin is that, you know, of course, and the Buddha actually articulates that. We do that in the morning chanting, saying sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair, or dukkha. But it also arises out of the quality of grasping, clinging, identifying. So that once we start to recognize that, because at the core of it is the kind of the grasping and clinging. And, you know, at first you start to see it in more coarse ways, but then as one starts to tune in and recognize, the real subtle ways that we do cling and sustain these emotions through our misapprehension of the true nature of things, but then we reckon, there is a way out of this. There's a way through this. There's a way to deal with that. And then those aspects of... This is where it's helpful to be consciously be directing attention to the qualities like loving kindness and compassion. These are... They're usually called, the Brahma-viharas, these divine abidings. One of the translations that I particularly appreciate is... mature emotions. It has a bit of a psychological tinge, but it's that sense, these are really mature emotions to be able to foster and to kind of aspire to live up to, and to be consciously cultivating those qualities of loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, gratitude, appreciation, sense of appreciation of Dhamma, kind of qualities of faith and confidence. These are like really consciously directing attention to those wholesome qualities of mind. That has a very powerful effect. And particularly in order, because you're always trying to balance, so that if the underlying tendency is to feel kind of swamped by sorrow or grief or other negative emotions, and one has to give oneself, it's like giving oneself permission, encouraging oneself to cultivate these brighter states of mind, states of being. And then the mind is always going to greed and gratification and indulging in this and that, and you want to sort of kind of slap its wrist or even, no, it's unattractive nature of the body. it's just these are antidotes and balancing, and you want to be, and you recognize, the point of balance is a quality of clarity and peace, and that's the attention you need to say, well, what is it that will foster that, bring me to that point? I remember reading that Ajahn Chah used to ask monastics to meditate in a charnel ground to alleviate lust. With no charnel ground at my disposal, how to work with this strong sensual desire in meditation? Thank you. We're actually carrying the charnel ground with us. I mean, here it is. Sort of, hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, and skin. And sort of looking at it in that way. And just the recollections of having a physical body. I mean, you have to feed it, and you stuff in one end and then it comes out the other end. And you're having to wash it. And you don't wash it and it just feels uncomfortable. And this is you sort of, it's something that we tend not to, we don't want to look at it. We don't want to pay attention to it. Don't do it here in this retreat. Try going without showering for a day or two or three. sort of an act of compassion for the rest of it. But it was a really, oh, wow, these human bodies are not so wonderful. What kind of sufferings does a non-returner experience? What motivates a non-returner to become an arahant? Well, on a certain level, I wouldn't know. the recognition that one of the aspects of, instead of a non-returner, there's still that quality of asamimana, the sense of I, the sense of me. And when we have that sense of I, the sense of me, then we compare ourselves to others. And even when you've seen through the reality of identification with experience, a body-mind experience, and you still see the mind doing that, that is suffering. You know, sort of knowing better and still falling for it. Not in any gross way, not creating any conflict or major suffering around it, but still seeing that it's there and that habit still has a power over the mind. There's a level of suffering there. There's the suffering of desire for more refined experience. How it phrased in the kind of the what's called the fetters, is that, say, yeah, that desire for fine material existence, and that desire for immaterial, sort of like that desire for more refinement, because that's the habit of the mind, is that what we have, we tend to underrate what we have and move to what we don't have. And especially in the mind that has relinquished a tremendous amount already, there's still that pull toward something that is more refined. And that sense of not being able to be fully content with what one's experiencing, and to relinquish that pull to something else, that in itself is suffering. It's a very interesting question, because it's, you think, well, how do we, and that in itself is the motivation to becoming an arahant, is to seeing the suffering, and even the refined, even the peaceful, there's still suffering. And recognition that one could be totally free, one could be totally awake. So that's all the questions.